we are kind of on step 12. We are on step 12. And I ended last week with a little bit of working with others. And when I think about step 12, I think about how people have a tendency to kind of really do one or the other part of it. Like there's the first half and the second half. It's they either carry the message to alcoholics or they practice the principles in all their affairs. And there, I know early in sobriety, I met this gentleman in meetings when I was first coming around this last go-round, who said, I only need the first step and the second half of the 12th step. So he just needed to not drink and carry the message to other alcoholics. He was, mind you, the most miserable human being I ever laid eyes on. And I thought, if I've got to be sober like this guy, somebody give me a gun. For me, not for him. Right. And I'd rather... I didn't understand the spiritual... I missed the whole part about having had a spiritual awakening as the result. Not one of many results. Not a result. And I love... I love language. They're very careful about the language. It's not a result of these steps. It's the result. The result. It's the only result. If you do everything in 1 through 11, you will have a spiritual awakening. It says way back in a doctor's opinion, that in order to get free of this disease, to have that psychic change, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, this is on page XXV, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. So I'm going to have a spiritual awakening, and at me, I was doomed. I had so many problems, I despaired of ever solving them. I find myself easily able to control my desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. There's just really kind of... Actually, there's really only 9, and the other 10, 11, and 12 is just the constant repetition of 1 through 9. Huh, it all ties together. So I'm thinking about how can I carry this message to alcoholics and not practice these principles in all my affairs? And how can I practice these principles in my affair? Practice all these principles in my affairs and not carry this message to alcoholics? And I'm also thinking about how I so have to be careful what message I'm carrying. A woman I know in the rooms from my home group, which is the Florham Park Saturday Morning 10:30 group, which is a great meeting if you're ever around in the area. We are a closed topic discussion, and we choose spiritual topics, and then we talk about just that topic, and people are respectful of it, which is wild for a discussion meeting. Somebody shared yesterday that they were listening to a speaker tape, and in the speaker tape, somebody recorded a speaker, and the speaker was talking about something that was clearly not AA. Like, it just wasn't. And this woman was fairly new, and it was a little mortifying to hear that there's something circulating out there that you can be a newcomer and you're listening to. They're not tapes anymore, are they? They're downloads and MP3s, and maybe there's a CD left floating. Oh, there's some CDs over here. And you can listen to something in as a substitution for a meeting or some other good AA interaction, and what you're getting is instead poison, which is, yep, I said poison for those of you who are listening to the recording. Not kidding. It's not good stuff. So, you know, I don't know. I was supposed to be done this week, but I think I'm going to have to come one more week. Yay. Because I can't really finish up without doing working with others and a little bit of the family afterward and a vision for you. So that's the plan for anyone who really wants the TV guide version. So why don't we start on page 98 in Working with Others, at the bottom of the page, that last paragraph now. So up until this point, we've talked about how we find alcoholics, and how we found alcoholics in 1939 is not the way we find alcoholics now. We find alcoholics when we go to meetings. Maybe you are on a list with intergroup and you get call-outs from treatment facilities, or maybe you're on the connection for people being released from halfway houses or prison, or maybe you go to beginners meetings and troll for newcomers. But, you know, there's nothing like being a newcomer and having 36 people come up to you after a meeting when you say you're new. It's really overwhelming. I remember, and it was a while ago, and it's overwhelming. It's like sharing that you're not having a great day in a meeting. Don't do that. People be coming with their advice and stuff. I think it's so funny. What do you mean, don't share my problems in a meeting? Well, not if you don't want everyone's opinion. Mm. You know, I didn't understand when I was new, but now I understand. It's protection. It's not telling me to not speak how I'm feeling. I can share my feelings, but not my situation. Good Lord. Because then everybody will tell you their situation and how they handled your situation, which is not a bad thing, because it's definitely a we program, but it's a we program about recovery, not about misery sharing. Whoever's listening to this on the interwebs is going to be like, what is this woman talking about? But I make sense eventually if this is your first time hearing me. I'm so obsessed with the fact that someone may listen to this. I don't think anyone will ever listen to it, but just in case. Anyway, so now the domestic. Wait, before I read. So we meet our newcomers in different ways. And sometimes when you've been on the road for a while with this journey, sometimes you get someone that you're working with that isn't brand new in time but hasn't had a spiritual awakening. Or they've had a spiritual awakening but they've fallen away from the spiritual way of life and they need to have a new spiritual experience and go through the steps a different way. Or they've had a life event that just blasted them and they're hurting and they need to come back to their higher power. And because they're in AA, this is usually the method that I seek when I'm feeling separated, is I kind of throw myself back in and I look to have a new experience. So not everyone that I work with is a wet drunk. Not everyone I work with has never been through the steps. And not everyone I work with needs to be spoon-fed, you know, the first 164. The answers are here and in enlarging our spiritual life, like it says earlier in the book. But it's not always lockstep through the 164. It's taking these principles and growing with them. But I think that it's worth it just to read a little bit more through this chapter. The other thing I think that's really interesting is that there's a lot of advice giving going on here. And there also is not, this is really skewed towards when the family units stay together through hell or high water. I'm going to read a little bit. You'll see what I'm saying. Now the domestic problem. There may be divorce, separation, or just strained relations. When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family and has thoroughly explained to them the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put those principles into action at home. This is a really important, important idea. I was the person who was like, well, now I'm not drinking and I'm not doing anything wrong and everyone should be really sensitive to my needs. And I was told that I'm the one with a problem and it's my job to be sensitive to everyone else. And I was like, I need a new sponsor. I couldn't believe that after everything I'd been through, this was like sobriety number two or three, not this sobriety, because this technically is like number nine for me. It's the one that counts, but early on, especially when I was younger, and you get this a lot with, I get this a lot with the younger women that I work with, it's like, well, you know, my parents won't take all the alcohol out of the house, or they won't, you know, do this, they're not understanding, they still expect me to make my bed or whatever, and I'm like, oh no, honey, the problem is yours. It's not their problem. It's your problem. You need to step up. And I think that you can't underestimate how important putting those principles into action at home right away. We're working with the person who's just dried up. We're working with the person who maybe just got home from treatment or who never went and is just getting their shit together. And right away, we're supposed to tell them to put the principles into action at home. Not after the fourth and fifth step, not after the eighth and ninth step, immediately. They've just gotten sober or are attempting to get sober. Immediately, they should put the principles into action at home. And what does that look like? How do they know how to do that? Well, my sponsor took me to her house, and she said, this is how it looks. It looks like cleaning up after yourself, helping where you can, you know, put away the dishes in the dishwasher, load the dishwasher, make your bed, go to the food store, help your mother, because at that time I couldn't, you know, live on my own with my daughter, show up and be a part of your family. And what I wanted to do was hide in the rooms of AA. What I wanted to do was go to 4 meetings a day and go to the diner and hang out and be where the boys are. And that's not how you get sober. Practicing these principles immediately is how you get sober. And I guess this is where she got it. Thanks, Roseanne. Though his family be at fault in many respects, he should not be concerned about that. He should concentrate on his own spiritual demonstration. Yeah. And so taking, you know, your prospect, taking their parents, spouses, children's, bosses, neighbors, inventory is like, that's not your business. That's keep your eyes on your own paper. That's what I say. Keep your eyes on your own paper. It's not about them. It's about you. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. In many homes, this is a difficult thing to do because sometimes the situation's downright crapalicious. And sometimes it's so bad that, you know, it would be suggested that the person you're working with has to leave the home. But that's really the point at which I say, you know, maybe you should talk to a social worker. Maybe you should talk to someone who is an expert in these things, because I'm just an AA person. And I'm not an expert because I'm not a social worker. I'm not an expert. So why don't we talk to someone who can help you? I have several friends who are social workers, so maybe we can talk, and they're in the rooms. Why don't you talk to my friend so-and-so and see, you know, if this is a situation that is beyond the limits of what's a safe boundary? And that's another really important thing about working with other people. If you have no experience with elephant hunting, don't talk about elephant hunting. Send them to someone who knows about elephant hunting. I happen to have experience with a certain type of tiger hunting. So all my friends send me the tiger hunters. It's not fair for me to try and help someone do something that I've never done or go through and process something that I've never, it's just not fair. It's like going to a brain surgeon for dental work. You know, it's not appropriate. If persisted in for a few months, the effect on a man's family is sure to be great. The most incompatible people discover they have a basis upon which they can meet. Little by little, the family may see their own defects and admit them. These can then be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. That little vignette there is a super awesome situation that might happen 1 in 25 times. After they have seen tangible results, the family will perhaps want to go along. These things will come to pass naturally and in good time provided. However, the alcoholic continues to demonstrate that he can be sober and considerate and helpful regardless of what anyone says or does. We don't read this to the alcoholic till way later. Because if they thought that this was happening right away, they'd just sit around and wait. Of course, we fall much below this standard many times, but we must try to repair the damage immediately lest we pay the penalty by a spree. Because we don't drink because of what people... I don't drink because of what people do to me. I drink because of shame and fear and generally feeling bad about myself. So as a brandy new getting sober person, I wouldn't have drank if I didn't, you know, try and act differently than I had before. I would have drank if I did act the same. And so I needed to try and be different. I needed everything about my life to be different. So I did need to unload the dishwasher, and I did need to make my bed, and I did need to take my daughter to the park instead of getting messed up and sitting and, you know, putting her in front of the TV. I needed to do everything different, and that's what I did. If there be divorce or separation, there should be no undue haste for the couple to get together. What they're saying is running back to the marriage that wasn't working or the relationship that wasn't working while you were drinking. When you stop drinking right away, not a good idea. The man should be sure of his recovery. The wife should fully understand his new way of life. If their old relationship is to be resumed, it must be on a better basis, since the former did not work. In this day and age, we have therapists and marriage counselors and family therapists, and you know, luckily we don't have to play that role in our sponsees' lives. If you have experience, I have experience. My experience was that the marriage did not need to be saved. If we have experience in having a marriage in and out of sobriety, then that's great and you can share it. But if you don't, again, I strongly suggest that you don't share experience if you haven't experienced. You don't share on something you haven't had experience with, just like at this meeting. This means a new This means their old relationship is to resume. It must be on a better basis since the former did not work. This means a new attitude and spirit all around. Sometimes it is to the best interest of all concerned that a couple remain apart. Obviously, no rule can be laid down. Let the alcoholic continue his program day by day. When the time for living together has come, it will be apparent to both parties. Okay, this should be in neon lights. Let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. If you don't have that underlined and highlighted 250 times, you should. We have seen men get well whose families have not returned at all. We have seen others slip when the family came back too soon. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. If you persist, not if he persists. It doesn't matter what he does. If you persist walking day by day in spiritual progress, you get to stay sober. He can go drink and shoot dope in an alley in Alphabet City, but if you persist, you get to stay sober. If he persists with you, things will work out for him too. But this isn't about his recovery. This is about yours. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you, not the other guy, will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. That is a lovely promise. I'm going to read it again so you hear it clearly. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. So no matter what's going on around you, if you stay connected with your higher power, you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your circumstances. That is awesome. That's really awesome. Goosebumps today. When working with a man and his family, you should take care not to participate in their quarrels. That can end in stitches and broken ribs. You may spoil your chance of being helpful if you do, because your prospect may think you're taking sides, the family may not want you around, it can get very ugly. And it's not your business. Any desire for me to get involved that deeply is my ego. I want to fix things. I like to fix things. But urge upon a man's family that he has been a very sick person and should be treated accordingly. You should warn against arousing resentment or jealousy by getting too involved. You should point out that his defects of character are not going to disappear overnight, and that might not even be your place. I would direct them to Al-Anon. Show them that he has entered upon a period of growth. Again, might be better for them to see it on their own. This is my opinion. I think that this book was written at a time when family relationships were much closer. I think they're much more tenuous now. Mm-hmm. And people felt more licensed to talk to each other about their families. Now there's this wall. You know, we all live like this with our phones and our iPads and our... I just think that to go to someone you don't know and talk to them about their family member, unless you've become very close with them, that this is like a fairy tale. You think about watching a movie from the 1940s, and people were just neighbors. Think about how neighbors were. They didn't just borrow a cup of sugar. They brought over the pie they made when they were done. Like, it's just a different world. And believe me, I'm very literal, as you can tell with the book. And so when I was newly 12-stepping people, I would try and get involved with the family, like, in the appropriate way, and they don't really want to hear it. Very rarely do they want to get close to you. I've had a couple of people, usually parents of younger, you know, young women, that want to know that their daughter's in good hands, that would want to talk to me, but I've had, you know, mothers of teenage daughters that hated me, resented me, because I could do what they could not. Because I was somebody else. So you never know what's going to happen. Sometimes the family gets big resentments because they can't fix their loved one and you can. So they get jealous of the family member going out to meetings when they want them to be home. They want them to get better. They go to treatment. They come home and say, I have to go to meetings every day. They're like, what do you mean? You were just gone for a month. And so it's a very fickle kind of thing. Ask them to remember when they are impatient the blessed fact of his sobriety. That's an interesting idea when you consider that most people do not understand that while they think acting, that being sober is like a normal state of affairs for other people, they don't understand what's involved for us. And for them to understand what's involved for us, they would have to be one of us. So I guess, I don't know if I'm going to be struck dead by Bill and Dr. Bob. I don't necessarily agree about them remembering the blessed fact of our sobriety so much as this is us. We are blessed by God to be sober, but I think it's really more about people starting to understand that this is an illness like every other illness, and this is about getting to a level playing field. It's just confusing because the medicine, for a long time people used to say meetings are my medicine. You know, meetings are not my medicine. God is my medicine. Spiritual principles are my medicine. But when we're new and we're going to 14 meetings a week because we haven't gotten through the work yet and we're still trying to find our connection, it looks like we're running just as hard as we were when we were drinking. At least I know it did for me. You try that when you have a 3-year-old and your parents are like, how is this different than it was before? Could you please explain? Just, I would say be really careful about what you tell your sponsees and what's appropriate. You know, I would never tell a single parent, you need to go to a meeting every day. Mm-hmm. It's not appropriate. You've been abandoning your children for the last how many years of your drinking. How about you spend time with your kids and go to a meeting when you can, but you make 5 phone calls a day. So I think it's a wrench for every knot situation. If you've been successful in solving your own domestic problems, tell the newcomer's family how that was accomplished. In this way, you can set them on the right track without becoming critical of them. The story of how you and your wife settled your difficulties is worth any amount of criticism. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. So this is kind of the fun part of the 12 step where we talk about, you know, what we can do once we've accomplished, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Assuming we are spiritually fit, so we're practicing the principles. And what are the principles of the 12 steps? There's a principle for every step. And if you Google the principle, I should have done it before I came and I didn't think of it until right now. There's a principle for every step, and like the first step principle is honesty, and the second step principle is open-mindedness, and there's a list of them if you Google the principles for the 12 steps, and humility and, you know, self-sacrifice and all these beautiful spiritual principles. So it's not so much that the steps themselves are the principles, is that there are spiritual principles that go along with the steps, which I will, if I have your email, I have a list, and I will send them out to anyone who's interested. And I can also, if you want to add yourself to the email list, I can bring that list back out at the end of the meeting. So assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things alcoholics are not supposed to do. Well, I don't know what I'm not supposed to do. I'm not supposed to drink, but that's pretty much all I've got. People have said we must not go where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures which show drinking scenes. I guess we'll have to stop watching Goodfellas. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide their bottles if we go into their houses. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows that this is not necessarily so. And furthermore, Tim's laughing at me. So I have a personal pet peeve, and that is when people use their alcoholism as a reason to shirk responsibility within their family. It's Thanksgiving, but I'm going to sit in an alcathon because I don't want to be around my family. I don't like my family, and I'm not going to be around them, and I'm going to say it's because I can't be around the alcohol. I call bullshit on that. You know, I spent years being around my family, but being emotionally and usually physically and definitely spiritually unavailable because I was too chemically altered to show up. And I would just kind of be this like lump that sat there kind of almost drooling, or sometimes actually drooling, or sometimes passed out. And not available to my own kid or my nieces or to help my mom or my dad or my sister. And that's not showing up for my family. And my living amends to my family is that I show up. And unless my family celebrates a holiday by doing flaming shots for 6 hours without stopping, and there's like trays of dry goods going around with topless waitresses, I can go. I really can. And, you know, I might not have to go for the whole time. And I might have to take some precautions, like maybe I go to a meeting first and I go to a meeting after, and maybe I make phone calls during. And And I'm telling you that there is no place that God's will can take me, that God's grace won't sustain me. So if I'm there for the right reason, if I'm there to be of service, I cut a lot of carrots. I play with the kids. I've played Twister as an adult for like a long, long time. And now it's a family tradition. We still play Twister on Thanksgiving. Before we eat, you can't play after. Can't be done. And the kids are now, you know, they were 3 and an infant when I got sober, and now they're going to be 21, and we still play Twister. Because it's really, really quite, we get the pets involved. It's pretty good stuff. It's really funny.
Great.
But, you know, I cut carrots, and I clean dishes, and I help with the appetizers. And, you know, I have years of not being available to my family to make up to. And if you truly have a good reason, it's between you and your God and your sponsor, then go serve. You know, be of service somewhere. Don't sit on your ass. This is my opinion, not the opinion of AA. Don't sit on your ass in an alcathon eating donuts and drinking coffee and feeling sorry for yourself about how you can't go to your family. Go serve someone else. You know, the excuse that it's the holidays and I'm blue because I can't be with my family, to me, it's like I almost can't go to meetings around the holidays for that reason. Like I go there and then I share something like this and people get angry. Our job is love and service. That's what Dr. Bob told us. He said love and service, practicing these principles in all our affairs, the 11-step prayer, you know, make me an instrument of your peace. Let me bring, you know, all of those things that are about giving of myself and none of the things that are about selfishness, because that's what's going to kill me. So I think that this paragraph is super important, and maybe next year I'm just going to run around and read this at all the meetings around the holidays. So sorry for that. I went off on a tangent. I guess that's what's fun about doing this. Maybe I'll never leave. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. Oh, he must not have done his steps appropriately. There is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be someplace like the Greenland ice cap. Even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. Ask any woman who has sent her husband to distant places on the theory he would escape the alcohol problem. In our belief, any scheme of combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. If the alcoholic tries to shield himself, he may succeed for a time, but he usually winds up with a bigger explosion than ever. We have tried these methods. These attempts to do the impossible have always failed. I personally have been sent to several continents to stop drinking. My parents started when I was like 16. No dice. So our rule is not to avoid a place where there is drinking if we have a legitimate reason for being there. That includes bars, nightclubs, dances, receptions, weddings, and even plain ordinary whoopee parties.
Whoopee!
Thank you. To a person who has had experience with an alcoholic, this may seem like tempting providence, with a capital P, that's what they used to call God back in the day, but it isn't. I myself have been to all of these things, except a whoopee party, because we don't have those now. But I have been to regular parties, and there was alcohol there. You will note that we made an important qualification. Therefore, ask yourself on each occasion, have I any good social, business, or personal reason for going to this place? Or am I expecting to steal a little vicarious pleasure from the atmosphere of such places? Do I have a good social, personal, or business reason? If my reason for going to a place where they serve alcohol is because I'm feeling nostalgic and I want to watch the other kids drink and just see if I can get that feeling again, that's a bad reason. I need to not do it. But if I have to go there for business, if I have a family member's wedding or bar mitzvah or christening or a wake or whatever I'm doing, and to not go would bring sadness or dishonor to my family in some way, or a friend, I need to saddle up and go, put on my big girl pants and move on. It says if you answer these questions satisfactorily, you need have no apprehension. Go or stay away, whichever seems best. But I have to go back to page 69, which is where I put all my relations to the test, right? Am I going to create jealousy, bitterness, or suspicion? Who am I going to hurt? If I don't go and be with my family at the holidays, if I don't go to the wake or the wedding, who am I hurting? Am I creating jealousy? Am I creating bitterness? Am I creating suspicion? Is somebody going to think, wow, Ari must not really give a crap about me? Or, wow, you know, Ari cares more about her AA friends than she does about our family. Because believe me, there was some of that when I was the first time, second, third time around when I was like 19, 20. I skipped a funeral on the pretense that I couldn't be around all the alcohol. I didn't want to go. I wanted to hook up with some guy. I'm not lying. I have nothing to hide. It was like 25 years ago. What do I care? Well, not that long, but it was 20 years ago. And that's who I was then. I was not drinking, but I was not practicing these principles in all my affairs. I was a bad, bad person. Sicker not drinking than drinking. Ugh, I feel sorry for that, Ari. That's a terrible place to be. But be sure you are on solid spiritual ground before you start. I wasn't then. And that your motive in going or not going is thoroughly good. If my motive is self-centered, I'm in trouble. Do not think of what you will get out of the occasion. Think of what you can bring to it. But if you are shaky, you had better work with another alcoholic instead. If I'm shaky, I should always also go back to step six. Well, actually, I should go back to step two. And I should ask God, ask myself and ask God, what part of my life am I not willing to trust God with? I should go back to that second step proposition and say, if God is everything, or, you know, if God is everything, is God everything or is God nothing? And if I still say God is everything, then what part of my life am I not trusting God with? What little area am I keeping to myself and saying, all right, you can have 11 twelfths of my life, but this part over here, that's for me. And I'm not sharing. Because that will be guaranteed the part that I'm having an issue with. Why sit with a long face in places where there is drinking, sighing about the good old days? If it is a happy occasion, try to increase the pleasure of those there. If a business occasion, go and attend to your business enthusiastically. If you are with a person who wants to eat in a bar, by all means go along. I love pub food. Let your friends know they are not to change their habits on your account. Because it's not their disease. It's your disease. At a proper time, I mean, really, do your friends that are sick ask you to take their medication? You know, that's kind of weird. At a proper time and place, explain to all your friends why alcohol disagrees with you. If you do this thoroughly, a few people will ask you to drink. If you still have friends left by the time you get sober, they'll know why alcohol disagrees with you. I didn't even have any friends left by the time I got sober. I had like one. And his agreement with me was like, if you make it to 90 days, I'll talk to you again. And if you don't bother calling. Where was I?
While
you were drinking, you were withdrawing from life little by little. Now you are getting back into the social life of this world. Don't start to withdraw again just because your friends drink liquor. Now, here's the truth of the matter. I've been sober, well, let's see. In 6 days, I will celebrate 16 years. And please don't clap because all the gratitude and the onus is on God. I just show up and I have been really, really lucky to be blessed with people who have pointed me in the right direction and been God's messenger in my life. With that being said, 90% of my friends at this point are sober. And some of them have spouses who are not, and some of them both people in the relationship are. But I have a couple really good friends who are not in the program that I've met over the years. They're not like old friends from back in the day, because like I said, I burned all those bridges on the way in, on the long and slow and then quick and fiery descent in. And it's really easy for me, because usually I go places with people who are sober. You know, I can go to a Dead & Company show, and of course I could fly the L balloons, or I could go on a vacation to an all-inclusive where everybody's drinking, but I'm with a couple couples and none of us drink, and it doesn't matter. But I can also go to, like, a big business trip in Vegas, which is, like, the free alcohol capital of the planet, and be okay because I'm there for business and I have my God with me everywhere I go. So it gets easier with time. If you're newer in the program, practice makes perfect. I mean, the more you do it, the more you know you can do it. And the one benefit of time, because time by itself is completely worthless in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion, because if you're not doing this work, then you're just accumulating days of white knuckling, which makes you miserable and, in my opinion, closer to a drink. But if you're doing this work and you're having this experience where your life is changing completely because of this spiritual awakening, you have spiritual awakening, you have a God in your life, and you have the experience of going to Las Vegas and the Caribbean and dead shows and dance clubs, and you go and you have a great time and you drink water and or Diet Coke or whatever, and you're cool because you're in the experience and you're having a great time doing it, and you're not thinking about what they're drinking, although about 1:30 in the morning it does become quite entertaining in certain spots, and that's cool too, but it's not about, but then you have that moment. I have this moment whenever I'm someplace new where I usually end up getting teary-eyed and realizing I would never be here if it weren't for my God and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have that moment sometimes when I'm walking my dog, and I have that moment when I'm trying to cook something. I'm such a bad cook. And I have that moment, like, I have very mundane, grateful moments, and I have really overwhelming sitting on the beach watching the sunset in Mexico, wondering, because I could never get off. I never had money to go anywhere, moments. And they're equally beautiful. So go everywhere and do everything with your God and your sobriety, but only in that order. You know, if you don't take God with you, it doesn't work. So your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. Maximum helpfulness. So we start out back on page 19. Is it 19? Hold on, let me look. I have to look. 20. Top of 20, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So back here, and there's a solution, before we even talked about doing the steps, we were told that the solution to this problem was constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. So now that we've done all these steps, we're back, we're here and working with others, the 12th step, and we are now suitable, if we've done this work correctly and honestly. And when I say correctly, I don't mean technically perfect. I mean if we've been as honest and as open and as willing as we can be in that moment. Not, I wasn't as honest in year two as I was in year seven, and I'm way more honest now than I could have been at year nine, and probably tomorrow I'll be a little more honest. So I'm at the place where I should be of maximum helpfulness to others, so never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. You should not hesitate to visit the most sordid spot on earth on such an errand. So don't be afraid to take detox commitments in Patterson and Newark because somebody's got to go. And don't be afraid to go to the prison because somebody's got to go. And don't be afraid to pick up a newcomer if you don't like their zip code, because God will take care of you. I promise you. I've done it. I have no doubt that... my husband says that I put good sense aside and I follow where AA takes me. And sometimes he gets like, do you want me to go with you? I'm like, no, I'm picking up a newcomer woman. She doesn't need to be intimidated by you. He's like 6'2" and all muscular and stuff. And I'm like, I'll be okay. And I always am. And sometimes I get scared because I go into bad neighborhoods, but I know I'm going to be all right. Many of us keep liquor in our homes. We often need it to carry green recruits through a severe hangover. Some of us still serve it to our friends, provided they are not alcoholic, but some of us think we should not serve liquor to anyone. We never argue this question. We feel that each family, in the light of their own circumstances, ought to decide for themselves, and I agree with that. We are careful never to show intolerance or hatred of drinking as an institution. I don't hate drinking. I just wish I could do it better. Experience shows that such an attitude is not helpful to anyone. Every new alcoholic looks for this spirit among us and is immensely relieved when he finds we are not witch burners. A spirit of intolerance might repel alcoholics whose lives could have been saved had it not been for such stupidity. We would not even do the cause of temperate drinking any good, for not one drinker in 1,000 likes to be told anything about alcohol by one who hates it. So just remember what it was like to come in here when you weren't quite ready yet, if you got here when you weren't quite ready, to be talked at. Also, let's remember that alcohol is an inanimate object, and as it resides in that bottle, it has no power to do anything. The problem is in my body. It's in my soul. It's in my mind. that when I put alcohol in my body, something bodily and mentally and spiritually different happens to me. And if you're an alcoholic, it happens to you. That alcohol by itself, sitting in the bottle, it's just a chemical it's like a chemical compound. And that's it. It's the same as vinegar or Wesson oil or just stuff in a bottle. Some of it smells better than others, but it's not perfume. But it could be. Sometimes if you leave perfume too long, it smells like alcohol. Someday, we hope that Alcoholics Anonymous will help the public to a better realization of the gravity of the alcoholic problem. But we shall be of little use if our attitude is one of bitterness or hostility. Drinkers will not stand for it. After all, our problems were of our own making. Bottles were only a symbol. Besides, we have stopped fighting anything, anybody or anything. We have to. So I just want to, I have 5 minutes and I just want to pop over. So the next three chapters are called the Forgotten Chapters. And one of them is to wives and was supposedly written by Lois and the ladies about what it was, and it was the kind of the wellspring of where Al-Anon began. I don't necessarily know that it wasn't heavily edited. There probably is some history on that, and I'm not going to comment on it. I hope that when you go through the work with a sponsor that you read to wives and try and look at this at alcoholism from the perspective of someone who lives with an alcoholic. The family afterward, and To Wives is about supporting your alcoholic. The family afterward is my favorite forgotten chapter, not because To the Employers is boring, but because I actually like that chapter, and now that I am an employer and I have employed people from the rooms, which is a whole different conversation. I like the family afterward because it talks about the real practicing these principles in all our affairs. And it talks about the family as a unit and what the real deal is. Because the first year, 18 months, 2 years after Bill, you know, got sober for the last time, was a real struggle for him and his family and Lois. And I think what people experience is really, you know, the hard part is not putting the drink down. The hard part is keeping the drink down. The hard part is, you know, you could be a grown person with an important job and real responsibilities, or a student who hasn't figured out exactly who you want to be yet. And everyone's looking at you, waiting for you to implode or explode or become someone. And the thing is we're all becoming someone. We're all figuring out who we are. And as you're getting sober, you're figuring out who you are even more without alcohol. And I love the family afterward. And this is, I think, a really interesting place to dovetail with the traditions in my own recovery, because if the steps show me how to live with myself and in the universe with, you know, and deal with my own stuff, then the traditions really show me how to live in a group. You know, I always read these kind of keeping in mind, like, our common welfare comes first as a family. So I don't really have time to get into any of it. I'm going to try and go through and pick out a couple of goodies to share with you next week, because I think it's such an important chapter about sharing with your sponsees on kind of what to expect, like what not to have ridiculous expectations from your family when you're newly sober, because damage has been done on both sides. But when you're the alcoholic, you know, I'm not responsible for someone else's damage. I'm responsible for the damage I did. And for me to continually point the finger, even if the damage was worse coming from someone else, if I don't stay on my side of the street, I'm as good as drunk every time. And sometimes it takes a long time for the family to recognize the change in their alcoholic. And that can be painful, because we love applause, recognition, parades, cookies, you know. And I remember that when I went to, the one and only time I went to treatment, I was 20, and I had this nurse, and she's from the Bronx. She was a tough lady, Carla. And I'd be like, I didn't make my bed. And we had to make our bed every day. And I made my bed like 4 days in a row. And I'm like, I made my bed 4 days in a row. She's like, do you want a cookie or a parade? Like, grown-ups make, I was 20. And she's like, grown-ups make their beds. Like, that's what they do. Like, this is what we do when we're grown-up parts of society. And I'm like, oh. Like, what? And that's how I think a lot of people feel in early sobriety is like, I'm not drinking and I made my bed and I bathed within the last 48 hours. Give me a prize. And, you know, never mind, I'm interacting with my family. I don't hang up on you when you call me. Just I'm showing up for this stupid job you made me get. Like, it's so hard to be in your skin before you've had a spiritual experience. At least it was for me. Just being in my skin and not drinking and not having a God of my understanding for me to let go of everything and being able to breathe at the same time was, like, way too much. And I felt really strongly that this chapter really helped to balance it for me to kind of, they really looked at it from both sides, like what the alcoholic is experiencing and what the family is experiencing, because as much as it was terrifying for me, the alcoholic, it was also terrifying for my people, because they're like, okay, all right, she's not drunk. But no, is she drunk? Like just is how long is this going to last and what does it mean? And afraid to hope that things were going to be okay, but afraid to not hope that things were going to be okay. And this is a family disease. And the attempt to address this as a family disease, when this was written, is, you know, light years ahead of the way that the medical community saw it. And it's still, you know, I think that the treatment community is still behind in addressing the family picture of this disease, in the sense that, you know, they'll send a kid to treatment when the parents still, you know, have three martinis after dinner each, and then send them back to the home, and not even ask the parents about their drinking habits. Like, how does that help? Or they'll take one parent out while the other one's like a raging alcoholic and send them to treatment, and then they come back to the home. Like, this is a really important piece of information for us as alcoholics and as sponsors about what to expect, what to, and how to, I don't want to say direct, but how to empathize with our sponsees and other people we meet in AA, and how hard it is to be new, and just walking this walk. Because we look fine, we look normal, we come out of treatment and we're not like jaundiced or yellow and we look okay, and maybe we've been away for 6 months, but we absolutely, when they talk about recreating our life, I mean, it's no joke. Like, I didn't have a clue, I hadn't felt an emotion for 20 years. You know, I stopped feeling the minute I picked up alcohol and drugs, I was 10 years old. I hadn't felt anything. And all of a sudden, every day, I had an emotion, or 6, or 26, or 100. And I'm like, crap. You know, getting from my bed to the shower was, like, terrifying. Work, kid, family, I'm like, oh, so much. And they wanted me to make my bed. You know, that was, like, overwhelming. Come downstairs and eat with the family, overwhelming. So the family afterward is, I'm going to go through there and pull out my greatest hits, my favorite things in there. And then I'm going to shut it down next week with a vision for you. You know, I think that's kind of it for tonight. I went over by 3 minutes, and I apologize profusely. And once again, thank you for giving me the opportunity to stay sober this week.